Hello, and welcome to the Resilient Life Podcast. Resilient Life is part of peakprosperity.com. It's where we focus on practical and actionable knowledge for building a better future. And I'm your host, Adam Taggart. A few months back, a Peak Prosperity reader on the East Coast wrote to me, asking if I was familiar with a small organic farming operation located near me in Northern California called Singing Frogs Farm. He had read an article extolling the remarkably high yields this farm produces, both in terms of crop yield and in terms of revenue per acre, using nothing but sustainable farming practices, free of pesticides, chemical fertilizers, conventional tilling, and even using less water, which is a big deal given the historic drought in the West these days. You should consider looking these guys up, the reader suggested. They'd be a good interview guest. Well, I couldn't agree more. Little did this reader know that my family's been a subscriber to the Singing Frog CSA program for the past few years. The farm, run by Paul and Elizabeth Kaiser, is located just over a mile from my house as the crow flies. So I've invited Paul and Elizabeth on the program to discuss the success behind their microfarm. Many of the practices they employ at Singing Frogs go beyond the standard ones used by traditional organic farmers, leading some to refer to their approach as Organic Farming 2.0. We'll find out what best practices this new approach entails. Paul and Elizabeth, thank you so much for making the time to join us today.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you very much.
Oh, it's a real pleasure. Now, give us your brief story, guys. How did you decide to become small-scale farmers in the first place?
Well, we actually met in Peace Corps in West Africa, in the Gambia, and I was doing agroforestry and environmental health.
And I was doing public health.
And so that human-environmental combination of focus we brought here to our property in Sebastopol, and we knew that we wanted to keep working with the soil and working with the community to make community healthier, both the environmental, ecological, as well as human community. And it was a matter of finding what avenue was best to do that with. And we knew that food production and food is obviously something that we eat three times a day, every single day, our entire life. And it is the basis of our health and who we are. So we figured food was definitely our area of focus, even though our background really is in ecology and human health as well. So
I think actually that background is very important in what brought us where we are, because we didn't go to school in agriculture and we weren't, you know, trained in what agriculture should be.
You weren't indoctrinated.
Exactly. So we started a small farm, and we started it traditionally as you are quote unquote supposed to, with tillage and so forth. And it just didn't seem right. And we were able to step back and evaluate and try a lot of different things. And really use observation in what is working, what is not working. And that was...
You put that really nicely. Those were miserable first couple of years trying to use tillage and tractors and discs and plows and breaking our backs to get one crop per season, followed by a cover crop in the winter, and then all that tillage all over again in the spring for one more crop for the summer, and then till it all under in the fall and do another cover crop. That was backbreaking work with such low productivity, and the soil was just getting worse and worse the more we did that.
Yes. We were noticing that the soil was getting worse. We were noticing that there were a lot less animals, both the large-scale animals as well as the small-scale animals. We would notice that we would till a field, and afterwards, our dog, our barn cats, the birds, all these animals would just line up around the edge of the field waiting for the feast that we had just killed in this field, and they would dig in and find it. And it just felt wrong. So
yeah, tillage wipes out snakes, wipes out gophers, wipes out ground nesting birds, wipes out the native bees, which are almost all ground nesting. I mean, tillage physically destroys macroorganisms as well as the microorganisms, fungus, bacteria, protozoans. And that's only half of why tillage is bad.
Wow. So we'll get into some of the specific practices you shifted to, but what helped you, what were your influences when you picked your head up and said, there's got to be a better way to do this? How did you guys begin to discover, was it trial and error, or were there influences? You mentioned observation, which I know is a big part of permaculture, but were there practices out there that you then began looking at more closely?
Well, Paul's background, as he just mentioned, was in agroforestry, and agroforestry is actually the precursor to permaculture. So I think that allowed us to look at it differently.
So by virtue of really having a focus on the ecology and agroforestry and putting in perennial hedgerows, we wanted to encourage are beneficial insects, the pollinators, etc., as well as songbirds and snakes, to have habitat and food resources year-round so that we would have our pest control taken care of for us. We put in these perennial hedgerows, perennial small shrubs and plants that would be there around the perimeters of the fields. And the more we began putting in perennial hedgerows, the less room there was for tractor turnarounds and tractor plowing and tractor disking. Plus, with the act of encouraging wildlife with hedgerows and then killing wildlife with a tractor, It just seemed so bass-ackwards that we had to shift how we were doing things. And we were very fortunate to get still currently our longest employee, Marty, has been with us now 5 or 6 years. Mm-hmm. And he's on paternity leave right now, which is wonderful, taking care of his newborn son. But Marty was a phenomenal employee, and he came to us from the UC Santa Cruz CASFIS program, which is the Farm and Gardening Sustainable Agriculture program. And his PhD actually was in the history of organic ag and nutrition and human nutrition. So his PhD work, not to mention all the other prior work, really got him in tune on the same level as us with ecological principles, soil principles, and beneficial management practices for farming. And when we hired him for that summer, as winter approached, we realized we don't want to lose this guy. Mm-hmm. We have to figure out how to grow food year round to keep Marty on our farm. He is a priceless employee to have, a priceless ally and friend to have on our farm. So we began going year round as soon as we hired him. And it was this combination of trial and error between him and us that allowed us to figure out methods to manage soil and manage continuous crop production year-round while building soil fertility and also having the revenue to pay him. So it was really finding an amazing person and realizing the ecological destruction going on through tillage.
Great. Well, let's get into the details then about what practices you actually started employing there. So, you know, tell us about the practices that are having the greatest success on your farm. I mean, here's what I've heard about it, that Singing Frog's farm has over 4 feet of fertile topsoil, and that compares with most other Northern California farms, which have less than one. Second, as you mentioned, you don't till or disk, and you water it less than other farms, and yet your productivity is much higher than other farms, including other organic farms. I've read that you get 5 to 7 harvests a year versus the standard sort of 1 to 2. And then I've also read that you're grossing over $100,000 per acre, which not only dwarfs, you know, other small organic farms that we've heard of, but exceeds the yields that vineyards, which your farm is surrounded by, enjoy. So first off, are all those stats true? And if so, what specific practices do you attribute your success to?
Yes, they're true, and there certainly need to be qualifiers for all those, but yes, they are true. We are producing about $95,000 to $100,000 in gross revenue per crop acre per year. The vineyards around us are only doing about $11,000 per crop acre per year. Wow. That's a Sonoma County average, and that's actually the California state average for small-scale, diversified, direct-market family farms like ours. It's also about $11,000 to $12,000 per crop acre per year is the average. Good farmers, friends of ours, neighbors, other people in the county, are doing more like $14,000 to $22,000 per crop acre per year, but it still is far below our 5 to 7 sequential crops in any given square foot of bed space that totals $95,000 to $100,000 in sales per crop acre per year.
Wow.
Now, in terms of the topsoil, I've been to farms that have 30, 60, 90 feet of topsoil for sure. It depends on where you go. And yes, many farms only have a foot of topsoil. The difference really comes down to how deep is the healthy plant available soil that is full of the nutrients that your plants want? Mm. How deep is that layer, and where do you have a hard pan, if any at all? Because tillage produces a hard pan. And so you have deep ripper teeth that can help break up a hard pan and allow for a little bit deeper drainage of your soils. But we had a fellow organic
farmer. Just to go back on that, so generally when you're tilling your discs or whatever you're tilling with, they will only go a certain depth,
right,
and they will always go that depth. So you're only tilling a certain section of that soil, and then the rest does not get tilled, and so it becomes compacted. And
you get that hard pan. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So that's what's happening there. We think about it, I think, very much in terms of soil carbon. And soil carbon is a lot of what composes the topsoil. It's It's what we need for the soil structure. We also think about it in terms of nitrogen. And the carbon and nitrogen...
Well, briefly, so soil is really composed of air, water, and mineral.
Yep.
And a little bit of organic matter. Air, water, and mineral alone is basically a beach or a sand dune, because mineral is just rock.
Yep.
It's the organic matter that you add into soil that makes it soil, as
yes.
opposed to sand or a beach or a sand dune. So that organic matter, when you pick up a handful of dirt and you smell it, what you're smelling is the organic matter. That's the life in the soil.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, soil is just air, water, and mineral. That organic matter typically only composed about 6 to 10% of soil around the planet. And that's in agricultural lands.
Well, that's pre-agricultural
lands. That was pre-agriculture, pre-human cultivation, but that's agricultural lands around the planet used to have 6 to 10% organic matter. With the advent of cultivation and tillage and plowing and disking, humans rapidly bring that organic matter levels in the agricultural soils down to 2%, 1%, 0.5%, 0.25%, etc. So the very act of tillage is removing the very thing that makes it soil and makes it alive and helps our plants survive.
And the part that I think is important is, where is that carbon going?
Mm-hmm.
That carbon is going right up in the air. And that is a major contributor to greenhouse gases. 11 to 14% of greenhouse gases come from agriculture. And that is not the diesel in the tractors. That is not, you know, trucking, you know, things across the country. That is by the act of tillage, breaking up the soil, bringing oxygen in there, sort of like a turbocharger on an engine, volatilizing the carbon, but also the nitrogen, and putting it up in the air. Those are the two things that farmers need most in their soil. And by the act of tillage, we're putting it back up.
Wow. You said about 11 to 14%.
About 14%.
Yeah.
Of global greenhouse gas emissions are from agriculture.
Wow.
Isn't that incredible? People don't talk about that. And
no,
it frustrates me. They talk about transportation. They talk about industry, all of that, but they don't talk about agriculture.
Interesting. I mean, our listeners know from past discussions a lot of the evils of modern big ag farming, but we've now found another important one to add to the list.
Well, and to add to that, so 2/3 of planetary soil carbon has already been lost through tillage and cultivation and farming, through creating food for humans over 10,000 years. We've already lost 2/3 of planetary soil carbon, most of it in the atmosphere. We only have 1/3 left. That's it.
Well, now let me be the hopeful one. You can put it back.
You can put it back. And that's part of what being no-till is about.
Yes. And the way that you put it back is via photosynthesis. Because when you have photosynthesis, what you're doing, the plants are taking sunlight and they're taking carbon dioxide. They're bringing it in and they're creating glucose. Then they're resynthesizing that into all sorts of other carbon-based products. Plants then push out through their roots as an exudate 30 to 40% of the carbon-based products that they make from CO2. Not for their own use. They're feeding the soil. They're feeding the microorganisms that are down there in the soil. And that is how we can get that carbon back out of the air and into the soil. And that's what really excites me.
So if you have a picture of a tilled field in your mind and think about the fields that you've driven by on a highway and you see all the plowing and tilling going on, and the result is a bare blank slate. It's just bare earth, exposed to the sun, exposed to the wind, and no plants in it. Well, photosynthesis is the one single factor that feeds our soil organisms and sequesters carbon back in the soil. And then you have tillage creating bare soil with no photosynthesis happening, no plants on it. What do you have? You have dying soil.
Right.
That's releasing greenhouse gas emissions and creating pollution, depleting the soil, and dying. It's very simple.
All right. So we understand sort of how modern standard farming practices kill the soils, as you've just mentioned. We understand that your farm has a much deeper level of micronutrient-rich, carbon-rich soil.
Okay.
How are you getting it?
A lot of people, especially with some of the articles that have been written about us, like to focus on the compost aspect. We like to focus on the no-till and soil management practices. There are many tools in the tool bag that allow us to improve our soil management for much better outcomes. We'll talk about those tools first and then the results. So one is there's no-till. I want to specify no-till right now. There are two kinds of no-till out there. If you were to do a Google search for no-till, you would find the mechanized version of no-till. And mechanized no-till is still tractor-based. It's usually used for corn, soy, wheat, all those big monocrops in the Midwest.
This is actually a really positive thing, that is that in the United States over the past few years, a huge percentage of our grain production is no-till, anywhere from 10 to 60%, depending upon the product that he just named.
And is that a change from how it was before? Or?
Yes, very much so. And I've talked to farmers who farm in Kansas, who are farming wheat and sorghum, and they say that they are having the same climactic conditions as their grandparents had in the Dust Bowl era, mm-hmm. but that it's holding the soil together, which that's fantastic news. The negative side to that, and
of the mechanized,
and we want to differentiate the two, is that one of the main ways that people deal, well, one of the main reasons for tillage is to deal with weeds. So those farmers, those conventional farmers, when they're not using tillage to deal with weeds, you can guess what they're using. They're using
pesticides,
glyphosate.
Herbicides. So a much higher usage of herbicides, and that's usually glyphosates, which is very unfortunate. They are also, their version of no-till means only tilling every second year or every third, fourth, or fifth year. They're still doing tillage in there. So they're creating...
It's not no-till, then. It's kind of less till.
Yes.
Well, yeah. The good part is they've really changed how they approach soil management, and they've really changed their thinking, and they've made a huge leap in that regard, and that's excellent. Unfortunately, it has brought along baggage like glyphosate and Roundup, and that has actually dramatically increased in its usage, the herbicides, because of the no-till movement. Yeah. But that's mechanized no-till.
Yes, and we are different.
We are non-mechanized no-till. We do not use the tractor at all. We don't use any kind of mechanization process for our no-till management. We're
no
rototillers,
people-based. No.
We're labor-based. Yeah. And we have an exceptional crew of employees who do a really amazing, highly skilled job of managing our soil on our farm. And how do we manage soil? Well, there are three ways that the USDA talks about repeatedly, as do all soil scientists. There are three main factors to focus on for better soil health. One is disturb the soil as little as possible. And the obvious answer to that is go no-till. The next two are keep a diversity of living plants in the ground as often as possible and keep the soil covered and protected as often as possible. Well, that second one, keep a diversity of living plants in the ground, that's all about photosynthesis. If you have photosynthesis and you have a diversity of plants, they are constantly feeding the soil and building back the carbon and nitrogen and the organism health in the soil so that you have the basic building blocks of nutrients for the plants to resist viruses, to resist diseases, to resist pests, to grow better, to have more nutrient density. We've all heard the numerous studies in Europe and the US that have shown about a 1/3 decrease in nutrient density of our vegetables over the past half century. That's because our organic matter has been declining rapidly over the past half century, and we simply don't have healthy enough soil to feed our plants so they can be nutrient dense.
So that's like when you go into a major grocery store, you get a tomato, you eat it, it tastes like
cardboard.
Yes.
And then that third part was keeping the soil protected and covered at all times. That goes back to how sun and wind not only volatilize nutrients out of the soil, creating greenhouse gases and depleting soil, but it also creates greater temperature fluctuations in the soil by having it bare and exposed. Mm-hmm. Those temperature fluctuations are not preferred by soil organisms, so it drives them down deeper in the soil where their populations can be fewer, because there's not as many resources for them to consume down there. So by having unprotected soil that is bare and exposed, like tillage creates, you are not only depleting soil, but killing off organisms, reducing their habitat, reducing their food sources, volatilizing nutrients. It's just all negative.
Okay. So help me picture this in my mind then. So you've got a crop.
Yep.
That you've grown, it's harvest time.
Sure.
You come and you harvest it.
Sure. Broccoli.
Broccoli, great. What happens to that patch where you grew the broccoli or whichever plant we're talking about here?
So typically, go for it.
Well, we will first harvest out the broccoli.
Mm-hmm.
So
you have all these
stalks
without broccoli anymore.
We have all the stalks with leaves and stems, but no broccoli.
Mm-hmm.
We are going to cut out the plants. We're not going to pull them out by the root. We're going to cut at the surface level or slightly below the surface level, leave that root structure in the ground because that is phenomenal food for the organisms in the soil. And also by tearing it up, we're really opening up that soil a lot. Then we're going to take that organic matter from the broccoli plant, which it's quite a lot. It's a really hefty stalk, all these leaves, and we're going to put it in our compost piles. We make and use quite a bit of compost. Then...
after the plants are cut and removed, then we go back and put down a fresh layer of compost and transplant the next crop in. So I like to use cauliflower. If we harvested cauliflower Wednesday morning for our CSA, by Wednesday late morning, cut the plants out, throw them in the compost pile, put down fresh compost, and Wednesday afternoon, transplant the next round of mini romaine lettuces or bulb fennel or leeks into the same bed.
And you're just planting them directly into that fresh layer of compost the roots of the old cauliflower.
And that means that same afternoon, you have newly deceased cauliflower roots beginning to die and decompose to feed the decomposers in the soil. Simultaneously, you just put in brand new roots of brand new transplants that are already beginning to photosynthesize and feed the soil organisms. So the soil organisms never have a window where there's no food for them. They always have a constant food source going into their soil. I want to throw that up, run a comparison by, which is if we were using tillage to transfer one crop to the next crop, that cauliflower would be done on a Wednesday morning, and we might do that afternoon or the next day or the next week. We might plow it all under. And then you have to wait a few weeks for decomposition to begin, and then you go back with a tiller and till it up to chop it more finely to help that decomposition process more rapidly. Then you wait a few more weeks for decomposition to really kick in and get towards the end, at which point you can do a final pass of the tiller, and then you might do a tilther, and then you'll prep your seed bed. You'll sow your seeds, wait a week for germination, and then wait 3 more weeks until you have a plant that's the size of a transplant. That whole process from one standing crop to the next transplant size standing crop on a typical tillage-based farm is 7 to 11 weeks. That's 7 to 11 weeks with multiple passes of tillage and bare soil the whole time. In our system, it's about 4 or 5 hours without any tillage.
Yeah.
We constantly have photosynthesis, constantly have food production. Those 7 to 11 weeks, I could have had 2 crops of mini romaine lettuces producing economic returns for me.
Right. So
while building soil.
You've collapsed the weeks to hours, which is amazing in itself. You've reduced the environmental degradation that all those tilling practices would do to the soil, which you detailed earlier, how injurious they can be to the land. And economically, you've given yourself basically 2 months to grow more crop in. Correct.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Hence, we're doing the 5 to 7 or 4 to 7 sequential crops in the same bed over a 12-month cycle. Whereas most farms do 1, maybe 2 crops sequentially in their fields per year.
Okay. Wow. So it sounds simple and it seems like it makes a lot of sense.
Right? I think all natural systems are very simple, but yet very complex.
Exceedingly complex.
Yeah.
When people ask us about it, there's a 3-step process. Pull the old crop out, put down compost, and put the new crop in. It's that simple. But if it were that simple, everyone would have already been doing it. It is incredibly complex, and it requires a whole lot of very holistic thinking and holistic management and observation and presence on the farm, right? Mm-hmm. You got to be walking your farm every day. You got to keep track of things. Part of what makes it successful is that we don't leave an old crop that's been harvested for 3 or 4 days or another week and let the weeds begin to come in. Once you have the weeds coming in, it makes a no-till system very challenging. Mm-hmm. But if you can, as soon as you harvest that crop, pull it out and get the next crop in, you've not allowed the weeds a chance to grow bigger than the expired crop and therefore produce flowers and seeds. And by putting on surface applied compost repeatedly, you are suppressing any weed seeds. So you're actually putting out a mulch layer with that surface applied compost before each crop.
Okay.
So we have weeds, but we basically do not weed because the weeds are always going to be below the canopy of those plants. The plants are always ahead of them. They're healthy. They're going in as transplant. And the weeds have a mulch covering them, so they've got to break through that, and they're far behind the plants. So we will deal with them once we've harvested out the crop. And we always have weeds, but they're small, they're minor,
okay.
And we don't bother.
So if it gets to the point in a certain area where you have a weed problem, where the weeds have gotten too big or whatever, is it the manual process of, okay, everybody, we're spending the next couple hours just everybody walking and grabbing. Is it a manual hand process?
If the weeds get out of control, it is really challenging to regain control. We've tried the permaculture sheet composting and sheet cardboard method to cover a bed. We've also used some black filter fabrics and black landscape fabrics so we can cover a bed without solarizing it. The fabrics are always breathable. So in fact, you have increased soil biology and insect decomposer activity under those black fabrics while the weeds are being killed and decomposed. And that's usually used to reclaim new land, or if we do get behind and a bed gets a little bit weedy on us, we can cover it with a black fabric for a few weeks or a month, and that helps us to reclaim the bed. without having to do the manual labor of weeding.
And we'll also use that if we're not ready for the next crop quite yet, which is very rare. But say, you know, at a certain time in the season, we'll want to put out all of our pepper and eggplant plants all at once. So we'll need quite a few beds all at once. So in preparation for that, we'll cover some so that, you know, like by the three rules that he was telling you, the soil is still being covered and you're not allowing the weeds to grow. And you've got active organisms working under there. But when you open it up, it's like chocolate cake under there. It's lovely.
Okay.
So one thing I'd love to mention is about the soil biology. And we have tested our total soil biology in the soil. We've done the PLFA test, phospholipid fatty acid test. And we'd like to do other tests as well. But on the chart for that test, if you have a 500 nanograms per gram unit return, you have poor soil biology. If you have 1,500 units, you have average soil biology. And if you have 3,500 units, you have excellent soil biology. And our tests have repeatedly come back between 3,800 and 6,000 units.
Wow.
So almost double the category excellent for total soil biology.
And in terms of just health, there are a lot of correlations being done right now between, you know, the probiotics and the positive biology that we have in our own system that we're learning so much about being part of our immune system and helping us in some, we don't even understand it. There is very much a similar situation happening in the soil and people don't understand. We go to UC Davis and ask researchers there and we don't know. And well, it looks like, and well, but maybe, but we can't, those are the answers we're getting. But it seems as if, you know.
Well, it makes a certain logic, right? I mean, the higher the micronutrients of the soil, the higher the biotic content of the soil, you know, the higher the biotic content of the fruit, right?
Yes. Exactly. And that has been, there have been a few organizations and nonprofits that are beginning to study soil nutrient density and crop nutrient density, and they're finding absolute strong direct correlations between those. And they'll take the same seed packet, divide it amongst 14 farms, and then measure the soil quality in the 14 farms and measure the carrot nutrient density on the 14 carrots, and they find absolute correlation between nutrient density of soil definitely affects the nutrient density of the crop. And we're thrilled by that.
Great. Well, so kind of to my earlier point of, I said it seems simple. Clearly it's not, not dead simple. But it seems like, what you're doing could be done by others who go up the same learning curve as you guys. So, are people beginning to take notes? Are you, what is keeping the rest of the, at least organic farming industry from just marching in lockstep right behind you and what you're doing? And, I'm going to sneak one more question in there too, which is, I mentioned earlier, people have called your approach sort of organic farming 2.0, meaning it adds a twist, some certain improvements on sort of the standard organic farming. Beyond the no-till part, are there any other parts of it too that you would say, hey, here's what we're doing that we wish other people would copy too?
I'll answer the second one first because it's the quick one.
Okay.
Which is, we don't even use organic pesticides or organic herbicides or organic fungicides. We don't use any organic sprays. We don't use any conventional sprays. Most organic farmers in our community, they still use one, two, or three different organic pesticides. And those pesticides still, they don't read name tags to find out if you're a good bug or a bad bug. They still kill indiscriminately. And as soon as you begin to use an organic or conventional pesticide once, you'll wipe out both your predators and your pest insects. So your beneficials and your pests. And if you wipe out the beneficials and pests, guess which ones come back faster? The pests do. They're like the cockroaches and the rabbits and the deer. They populate faster. So as soon as you use a pesticide once, you have to keep using it. It's a pesticide treadmill. It's been talked about a lot. And that's the same in organic. And I really wish all organic farms could get back to the real founding principles of organic agriculture, which was not to use those kinds of off-farm resources, but to really focus on creating a healthy, resilient, viable Mother Nature ecosystem on your farm and around your farm to do all that pest control for you. We have not had any aphids this entire spring or winter, despite the fact that half of our acreage is covered in brassicas and fava beans that are magnets for aphids.
Well,
and we just haven't had aphids.
In addition to that, there's, you know, very well-known rules, like you don't plant tomatoes in the same place year after year. You don't plant cucurbits, like put pumpkins and cucumbers in the same place because you get buildup of viruses. We haven't found that to be true at all. We've got our tomatoes in the same place year after year. Well, not exactly the same place, but similar places.
But we haven't had any viruses or diseases of any kinds. And so the crop rotation for us is not about ensuring that certain crops don't follow themselves in the same spot. For us, the crop rotation is all about just drawing down different nutrients in the soil.
Correct.
Right.
Utilizing different ones.
And having just diversity of things in the field constantly. So we grow 140 different crops. But crop rotation for us is more about just diversity and beauty and drawing down different nutrients.
And just to be clear, that's 140 different crops on 3 active acres,
yes.
Right? Is that true?
Correct. You got it.
Wow, that's super impressive.
It's intensive.
I'll talk a little bit to your question about other farmers. I think it's really hard to change, especially if you've been told one thing and this is how we farm and this is how we farm and you see everybody else farming that way and you have John Deere selling you tractors to do just this thing, and you've got workshops on what kind of implements you need as a small farmer or a large farmer and that sort of thing. I think it's really scary to look at doing it differently. How would you do that? And we often have 2 different responses when we tell people about our farming system. And one of them is, well, you couldn't do that on a large scale, or how would you scale up? Usually that's the first question I get. And I think that's, you know, if it's good, make it bigger and better, or make it bigger, it, right? And for us, I think the point is, well, first of all, that is actually why we started talking about our revenue. It's not that I want to, you know, boast and no. It's to say, wait, don't put us down because we're a tiny, you know, oh, there's just a backyard garden, basically.
Right. Well, it opens ears. It's hard to dismiss when you have, you know,
results like that. When we have 3 acres that we're, you know, doing 95 to 100,000 per acre, we're not producing what a normal 3-acre farm produces. We're producing more like what a 20-acre farm or 25-acre farm does. So we've used that number more to show this is important. And then on the other side, wouldn't it be phenomenal to have 100 3-acre farms closer to city centers rather than 100-acre farms 200 miles away?
Right.
So we really want to focus on scaling up the number of small farms
yes.
near population centers.
Yes.
And that's the way we can scale this up. Yes, I could also do this on 10 acres or 20 acres. We could, no question about it. It just takes a lot of management and a lot of awesome employees, but we could easily scale this up. We just don't want to. We want to keep it at this 3-acre level. It really works well for us, and it's generating tons of revenue. So yeah, when farmers come to us and hear us speak at different presentations, one response is about scaling up. Another one is they often say, oh, that'll never work on my farm. You can't do it. I've got clay. I've got rock. I've got snow. I've got whatever. And I'll get back to that response in a second, because the other response is, that's awesome, and I'm thrilled, and I want to try it on my farm. And honestly, she mentioned change is hard. For new farmers, people who have not yet actually broken ground on their own farm, they've just worked on other people's farms, and they're just getting ready to begin their own farm.
Yeah.
If they come across what we're doing and they come on a farm tour or hear us speak, they go back to their farm and they sell the plow, they sell the disc, they sell the tillers, and they go straight to no-till, and they're thrilled by it. And so that actually goes to the example of you can do it on other soil types in other climates, not just sandy loam and Sebastopol.
Right. And there are 3 other farms in Sonoma County, our county here, that are starting these practices. We also have met a young farmer who was just starting up a couple years ago, came from a different career down in Southern California and said, I want to try farming. Mm-hmm. And he started Googling soil health and farming, and no-till kept coming up. He said, great, I'd like to go find some no-till farms. And he couldn't find any.
Couldn't find any.
He visited 40 different farms in California. Yep. And then he met us presenting at a California Small Farm Conference and was just thrilled. But still at the same time, then when he started up that season, he said, everybody's doing this tillage thing. You're the only people. I don't know if I can put all my eggs in that basket. So he split it 50-50.
Mm-hmm.
He did half of his farm in tillage and half of his farm in no-till. And he, this is Michael Wammen, and he is
Hillview Farms
in
Auburn.
His girlfriend Shannon are up in Auburn, and they have very poor soil. It's rock and it's clay. And after halfway through their first season, they looked at the differences between the two fields, and
he was already making, by September, October, he had made about $33,000 in revenue on his no-till field. And on his same size tillage field, he'd made about $4,500.
Wow. Right.
So an eighth of the revenue on the tillage field. And then he looked at the soil in two fields. And the field that had tillage, the soil was becoming concrete. It was cracking and drying. It wasn't holding water. He couldn't smell the earth. He couldn't put his fingers in it.
Yep.
And the no-till fields, dig down deep with his bare fingers, pulling up this deep, rich, black earth with earthworms breaking down the clay. It's like clay and rock didn't stop the no-till. It was phenomenal. And so now this year, he has converted everything over to no-till.
Well, that's a great story. For those listening to Auburn is located, what, probably about 3 hours away from us in California. I mean, it's a lot drier up there. It gets a lot hotter.
And snow.
Yeah, and colder too in the winter. Yep. Yeah. So, you know, you can easily see how, you know, a tillage can kind of bake there in the sun. And it's great to hear that the no-till, you know, was unaffected by that.
Yeah.
It is interesting. I don't think he uses exactly the same practice you do, but I've interviewed Jean-Martin Fortier, the market gardener, and I was amazed at what he's able to do up in Quebec, because I'm from New England, and, you know, Quebec was the place where we knew it was incredibly cold, right? Us hardy New Englanders.
Yes.
You know, short growing seasons, you know, harsh conditions, and I think he was able to do something like 150 thousand Canadian on a acre and a half or whatever, which is sort of roughly the same economics as you guys, but it's a testament to if you use these practices, they really can be applied in many different types of growing zones. You don't have to be in Sebastopol, where we do have a little bit of an embarrassment of a growing climate here and good soil, but clearly you guys are outperforming other farms in the area. So,
and another example is Elliot Coleman in Maine. And Elliot Coleman with Four Seasons Farm, he's doing the same kind of $100,000 in sales per crop acre per year.
Yeah.
But he's in his 70s now. He's looking towards retirement. So he's going to begin cutting back on his farming so he doesn't work as hard. And what he's cutting back on, he's going to cut back on his summer crops. He's going to focus on his fall, winter, and spring crops in Maine on rock in the freezing cold. And Elliot Coleman and Jean-Martin Fortier, both of them have very similar farming practices to themselves, to each other, as well as fairly similar to us. But we have a very strong, heavy focus on soil and soil management and no-till. And there are a few things that the two of those heroes of organic small-scale ag, there's a few things that they could do to reduce the tillage for sure, or even get rid of it entirely. But we're all sort of talking about the same kind of increasing productivity, increasing employment opportunities, skilled employment opportunities, and trying to make it year-round. It doesn't matter the climate, doesn't matter the soil, doesn't matter the community. Getting year-round permanent employment, year-round permanent food production for us humans who have to eat 12 months a year, and then doing it all in a way that can actually benefit the environment you're growing your food in, increasing the ecological returns, increasing the resiliency, therefore decreasing water needs because your soil is healthier.
All right. Well, that just all sounds so great, and it's such an exciting time, I think, in this field because there are emerging models of success that are beginning to become apparent that you guys are right at the vanguard with, along with some of the folks that you mentioned. For those folks that are, you know, listening to this, inspired by what you're saying, you know, what can people be doing to support this movement in their local areas? You know, not everybody is going to run off and create their own micro farm, though some may want to, but is it joining the CSAs that these companies might be running? Is it
certainly?
Yeah, I mean, what else can they do to basically be agitating for your vision of more small farms like this doing the no-till practice?
Every time you have a middle person, the story of how things get produced gets lost, and the consumer of that product doesn't know how it's produced and can't really give feedback to how they want it produced when you have middle people. So buying direct from your farmer, whether it's a CSA or farmer's market, is one great option, no question about
it. It's becoming a little cliche, but know your farmer.
But the other...
It works, is what you're saying?
Yes.
Yeah.
So in addition to not having that middle person between the producer and the consumer, it's sort of the same idea as the absentee landlord, and they're not going to have as much of a focus on the three legs of sustainability if they're not there at their farm managing it. So if you're buying local food from a local farmer, you know that they are not an absentee landlord. They're on their property. They're taking care of their farm. They're growing it themselves. They're aware of the ecological conditions on and around their farm. So you can have that discussion with them saying, well, what are you doing for the beneficial insects on your farm? What are you doing for the native bees on your farm? What are you doing for the other songbirds and snakes and other wildlife that inhabit your farm? What kinds of hedgerows have you been putting in? How are you managing the soil? So by having that direct conversation with the farmer themselves who is living on land and growing that food, you can elevate the level of conversation away from just the economics of toil and labor on a farm that's based in tillage and everyone's breaking their backs to do it, into a level of farming can be prosperous and it can be beneficial to the farmer, to the employees, and to the environment that it's grown in, as well as the community that consumes the food. And we can get that elevated, that discussion elevated to new levels of a virtuous cycle where things all benefit from our actions, not get degraded from our
Great.
Actions.
Great. So not only know your farmer, but get engaged, ask questions.
Yeah.
Ask which of these policies and practices they're thinking of, and if they're not doing it, why not, and all that stuff.
And we also realize that here in California, we're very lucky at having so many small farmers and the availability of organic produce. We've heard recently from a lot of people from other parts of the country where their only option is growing their own food. They can't find any fresh vegetables that they really believe in, I'll leave it at that.
Right. Well, but, you know, even some of the people listening to this may actually have, you know, a couple of acres that they're not using may be able to attract some farmers that want to, you know, try their hand at 3 acres
and
this type of method.
Because getting access to land for farmers is very challenging. So helping young farmers access land is fantastic. And a lot of the young farmers we know they have that some sort of situation like that where they're getting very low rent or...
Right. I mean, the capital hurdles for a young person to enter farming is really tough. So anything that, you know,
any small business. Right. Yeah.
And back to that focus on having that conversation with your local farmer. I love supporting backyard gardeners. I love encouraging backyard gardeners to view their backyard gardening management system differently. But we really have to change how agriculture works on this planet. 70% of the land area in the United States is managed by farmers or ranchers. That 70% of the land area is what we need to change. Backyard gardens, that's a strong force of people, but it means tens of millions of people to affect acreage, not hundreds of thousands of acres, but just backyards. We need to change the few tens of thousands of farmers and ranchers who are managing hundreds of millions of acres across our country and the world so that we can get them to adapt better soil management practices, better ecological practices to really elevate things so that our process by which we produce food also benefits positively the ecology that the food is grown in. We can't just have a system that breaks even or deteriorates the system. We have to be regenerating the system through the very act of using that system.
Well, well said, and I couldn't agree more. Sadly, I think few of us will hold our breath that the USDA and the Big Ag Consortium is going to mobilize on this in the timeline that we'd love for them to, but very important for us to be agitating for this change and doing all we can to promote it. I want to segue to something you mentioned earlier because it's based on a similar sense of frustration with sort of how the decision-making works in the conventional ag industry. And that's, you mentioned pollinators briefly. We've just had a very active discussion on the site around the plight of the pollinator, specifically the collapse of the honeybee population. And of course, we just know them as a signal species here. There are many other wild bees and wild pollinators that are just equally as important. But we're able to track the collapse of the honeybee population much more directly. But a lot of that seems to be due to pesticides, specifically a class called neonicotinoids.
Yep.
And there seems to be a preponderance of data that if it doesn't prove, it strongly suggests that those pesticides are directly linked to the collapse in the pollinators. And yet we are not taking the types of defensive measures you would expect for something as important as this, right? I mean, we're really sort of we're putting our ecosystems at risk, and you would think at a minimum we might say, look, why don't we just not use that class of pesticides for a year or two until we have some conclusive data one way or the other?
Good thing.
Instead, we're just saying, well, we won't do more than what we're doing, but we're going to continue what we're doing until we know more, right? It's kind of, you know, innocent until proven guilty, where in a case like this, you'd think it might be a little bit more wise to approach it from the reverse. Any comments on that and anything to talk about what you're doing in your style of farming that is pollinator supportive, encouraging?
The neonicotinoids are certainly one of many problems. It's always complex. You never have a single answer to a black and white answer to a complex problem like this. But if you look at the habitat and food and fodder resources for native bees and honeybees alike, we have dramatically reduced wild areas and we have increased monocrops and asphalt. So we have left our native bees and domesticated honeybees with the challenge of no food and no shelter for them. And so when you take away their food and you add in neonicotinoids, all of a sudden you've taken a very challenged population that's already on the brink and not finding the right amount of amino acids and proteins and vitamins to keep their own immune systems healthy. And then you add in a toxin, environmental toxin like the neonics, that obviously exacerbates the other problems created by loss of habitat and loss of food resources. You think of our domesticated honeybees, and just a few months ago in February and March, when our almond crop was flowering in California, about roughly 95% of all the domesticated honeybee hives in the entire country were here in California to pollinate our almonds.
That's
crazy. So what happens for 5 weeks? 95% of the honeybees in the country get one food source for 5 weeks. That's like you or I eating a bowl of rice for breakfast, lunch, and dinner for 5 weeks.
Well, it's like you and I and everyone else in America crammed into one state
that
eating
too.
Just that rice.
But if you think about what would your immune system look like if you had rice three meals a day
right. For
5 weeks and nothing else, just one food source. It reduces their immune systems. It reduces their overall resiliency so that when you add in neonics and other environmental toxins, of course it wipes them out. They're weak. They're not getting the food they need. So on our farm, we're actually certified bee-friendly farm. We are a certified bee-friendly farm. Not all organic farms can even be certified bee-friendly, because being bee-friendly means you're going a step above and beyond to ensure that you are not applying pesticides, not applying insecticides, making sure that you're not even putting herbicides down, because herbicides can negatively affect them, and making sure that you don't do tillage, because tillage, 70 or 75% of native bees are ground nesting. What does tillage do? It destroys the entire top 6 to 10 inches of soil. So you're simply wiping out your native bees through tillage. There's been some great research out of the University of California at Santa Cruz looking at domesticated honeybees and native bees. And they found that, at least here in the US, our native bees co-evolved with cucurbits, like cucumbers, melons, squashes, etc. And because of that co-evolution, our native bees are far superior at pollinating cucurbits. In fact, our native bees, it only takes a few dozen native bees to pollinate an acre of cucurbits as effectively as an entire hive of 30,000 honeybees, domesticated honeybees. So not only are they more efficient, but domesticated honeybees, it turns out, are incredibly lazy. They don't pollinate very well. They tend to fly in straight lines. They don't zigzag around. And they're lazy and slow about it until you introduce competition in the form of native bees. And once native bees are present with domesticated honeybees, the domesticated honeybees actually triple the efficacy at which they begin pollinating.
Oh, wow.
So to have native bees in conjunction with domesticated honeybees is a boon to the farmer. Our cucumber production, we're getting 800 pounds of cucumbers off of 250 bed feet doing only 20 minutes of drip irrigation twice a week. And we're getting huge productivity.
Wow, wait a minute. You grow cucumbers and you only do drip irrigating twice a week?
20 minutes each on those cukes.
That is unbelievable.
Yes. Pretty normal for all of our crops.
Wow.
Yeah.
And we never got to the water part.
No, we didn't.
But when we started out farming and we were doing full organic tillage, we were usually irrigating 2 or 3 hours a drip every other day or every third day. And now that we've gone no-till and brought our organic matter, we didn't even mention organic matter numbers, but now we've brought organic matter back up by 300%, we're no longer irrigating 2 or 3 hours a drip every other day or every third day. We're irrigating about 50 minutes a drip once a week.
Wow, that's crazy. I sense that there's a whole other podcast there in terms of the whole water management aspect
of
this.
Oodles of number.
Finish that.
And on the number, we mentioned that soil organic matter starts at 6-10%, and through tillage, we bring it down to below 2%. There's an important number here.
We as a society.
Every 1 percentage point of soil organic matter allows an acre of soil to hold an additional 16,500 gallons of plant available water in the top 12 inches. So if you go from 8% organic matter down to 1% organic matter, you have just lost the capacity to hold 100,000 gallons of water per acre in the top 12 inches. That's where our drought resiliency has gone. We are suffering drought conditions not because of a lack of rainfall entirely, but also because of a lack of soil's ability to hold the water.
Yeah.
So that's part of why we irrigate so little, is because the water that we put into our soil stays right there and becomes available to plants really efficiently. So our soil organic matter used to be 2.4% at the beginning of our no-till experiment. And now we've been doing no-till 5-6 years, our 2.4% organic matter is back up to 8 and 9 and 10% soil organic matter. We brought it back to where it was natively before cultivation ever happened.
And so that's why we can water so little.
Oh, that's fantastic. It's almost like your personal wetlands on the top of your your soil there.
Yes.
Fantastic. Well, look, it's been a great conversation. I know there's several topics that we'd love to have more time to go into deeply. Hopefully that just means we can have you guys back at some point in the future and delve into those.
That'd be great.
But very inspiring. And I'm sure people that have been listening are similarly inspired. For those that are, where can they go to learn more about your guys' work?
You can go to our website, which is www.singingfrogsfarm.com.
Frogs, plural, farm, singular. Correct. Singing Frogs Farm.
And we are trying to get more information out there. We are also running a farm and have a family with two small children, mm-hmm. so that is challenging. we have all sorts of dreams about different ways to get this out there.
Okay, great. But basically,
we'll
go to your site, and I know if you Google Singing Frog Farm, Singing Frogs Farm, there's actually a lot of previous interviews and whatnot you guys have given.
And we post a lot to our Facebook page, and we also offer a lot of farm tours. We had about 950 people come on farm tours last year, so we'd love to invite you to check out our events page on the website to look for when we have any public farm tours happening, or you can schedule your own farm tour if you want as well. We do a lot of consulting-based farm tours and other education.
Great. So if people listening or find themselves in Sonoma County and want to swing by, it's a possibility?
Yes, absolutely.
It is a possibility.
But call first or schedule them through email. We definitely are very busy and have lots of interest.
Fantastic. Well, thank you guys so much for coming here today. It's been a great conversation.
Adam, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.